Okay, so we're going to go ahead and start. Good morning, and thank you for attending session 226, titled Genealogy, Melaninated Style. Please silence your cell phones and be respectful during the session. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. At the desk, you can purchase other Sunstone merchandise with our More Than One Way to Mormon logo. We also encourage you to check out the bookstore in the center ballroom. Please support Benchmark Books by purchasing a book or two. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. And Brindis's, I'm really happy to be able to introduce Brindis. I'm excited to see. I've had very slight encounters with genealogy involving people of color in the U.S., and so I'm really excited to see what she did and where she went with it. For LDS church members who are more melaninated than others, family history can be extremely daunting, colonization, forced migration, and for many of African descent, slavery have had a devastating impact on records about their ancestors. For example, the grandfather, the paternal grandfather of Brindis, he was born in slavery. So that's how close it is. It's not that far away. Brindis is going to present tips and strategies for overcoming these obstacles. She was raised in the African-American Baptist faith tradition and joined the LDS Church in January of 2008. She has served as a family history consultant, Relief Society teacher, Relief Society second counselor, and Relief Society president. She is an attorney and has her own firm, Jenkins & Roberts, LLC. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm going to switch views and go ahead and get started. As Corey said, thank you for coming. Our group is small, so I hope we can have some good discussion. And the title of the session is Genealogy, Melaninated Style. And basically the point I was trying to make is that for those of us of color, particularly those of us of African descent who live in the South, genealogy is not the easy task, and doing our family history is not the easy task that it may be for others. We run into a lot of things that make it exceedingly difficult, and I just wanted to share some of my successes, my frustrations, some of my tips in dealing with it. Let me get here. Come help me, Christian. I'm too close to... Oh, I see it. Okay. All right. Here's a picture of my maternal great-great-grandparents. That's Richard and Edie Spencer. Richard and Edie both were born. Richard may have been born about 1835. Edie was born somewhere around 1842. Edie lived until 1923. Richard lived until 1907. It's very important that Edie lived, or very fortunate for my search, that Edie lived until 1923, because Georgia did not start requiring by law birth and death certificates until 1919. And then some counties thought that was a newfangled, ridiculous idea. So it took counties a while to get into the process of issuing birth and death certificates. But by the time Edie died in 1923, the county where I was born and the county where she lived, Scriven County, was issuing death certificates. So I was able to get her death certificate and to get additional information from her death certificate. Now, this is a picture of my little grandson. He was born September the 30th, 2016. One of since his birth, his father is white. My younger daughter married her, I guess, elementary school sweetheart, who happened to be a young white man. And so I was adding William Ryan to the family tree, and I added that side of the family, and was just struck by the difference in the way when you started adding that family, they already knew more than I did, but the number of leaves that appeared in Ancestry.com. I mean, it was just like they were popping up all over the place, and I'll show you that in a minute. So my genealogical journey, I'm almost 60 years old, so in the 70s, I was in college. When Roots came out, I was in college. So for me, like so many other people of African descent here in the United States, what started me on my genealogical journey was Roots. I was captivated by the miniseries. I wanted that moment in Roots when James Earl Jones's character exclaims, "I found you." And oops. Oh dear. I went too fast. Hold on a minute. If it cooperates, it's going to pull up that clip that I was talking about. But yeah, it is incredibly slow.
His father again is a fool.
All right, so for those of you who may not remember Roots, may be too young, it was a miniseries based on Alex Haley's novel. And at the end of the miniseries, James Earl Jones's character, James Earl Jones was playing Alex Haley, went back to Africa and was able to connect with a storyteller, and that storyteller was able to tell him about Kunta Kinte. So that is what this scene is saying. He's been looking for him, and he's exclaiming, "I found you, you old African, Kunta Kinte." And I wanted that moment. I wanted to be able to go back to whatever African nation my ancestors had come from. I wanted to be able to go to my tribe. I wanted to be able to find my village. I wanted someone to be able to identify my ancestors so that I could too say, "I found you, you old African." Wasn't quite that easy, but I started at phase one, and I called myself then the eager dabbler. I was so excited and was just sort of running here, there, and yon. I was confused, I was perplexed, I was disorganized. And I spent most of my time during this phase just sort of jotting down things, typing things into the computer, adding them to Ancestry.com, listening to stories that relatives told me. And I was one of those African American families where we regaled ourselves with stories about our Creek and Cherokee ancestors. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. Unfortunately, what I didn't do during this period is I didn't take the time to sit down and talk to and interview a lot of my older relatives. And unfortunately, several of them died during this period. Okay, the next phase, I call it all in. And that's when I had all the subscriptions to all the services. Ancestry.com, genealogy.com. I mean, if it had anything to do with genealogy, I had a subscription to it. And I spent countless hours poring over census records, asking relatives questions, visiting cemeteries, visiting courthouses, and writing a family history. Kind of one of the results of that, poring over census records when you already have weak eyes, that's not necessarily a good combination. So one of the results of all of that is I exacerbated my already somewhat poor vision. So I call my current stage genealogy with intent. I've come to peace with the mistakes and missed opportunities of the past, and I am embracing all the tools, DNA testing, online resources, everything that's available. And so how I got started was really figuring out, the first question was, where do my ancestors live? I was telling people before, if you see the red dot there, that is Scriven County in Sylvania, in Georgia. It's a county about 60 miles north of Savannah, which is in Chatham County. And then I started asking myself, what was happening in the world? What was happening in the region? What was happening in that area during the time that my relatives lived there? And one thing that proved to be very, very important was remembering that boundary lines had often changed. Scriven, for those of you who know anything about Georgia history, Georgia now has 159 counties. But some of those, some of those counties were formed by breaking up other counties. And one of the things I learned as I read the history of Scriven County is that in 1905, parts of Scriven County and a couple of neighboring counties were taken to create yet another county, Jenkins County, where Millen is. So my ancestors went to bed one night living in Scriven County. They woke up the next morning and they lived in a totally different county. Again, because that was a new county, it picked up on all the ideas about death certificates and birth certificates. So the fact that that county split off, or that part of the county split off, actually helped me in my search because there were more records to be found. As I said, it's really important to remember the geography and the history of the areas, or find out about of the areas where your ancestors live. If you look at the gray map, you'll see there's a big highway called 301. That's the U.S. highway that goes through Scriven County. You actually could go from Florida to New York before the interstates were built. It was like a major thoroughfare. And then you see the smaller highways, Highway 17, Highway 21, Highway 24. Each one of those highways actually played a part in my family history. So I started with what I knew. I wrote down the things that people had told me. I wrote down what I could remember about my ancestors and relatives. And because I started so long ago, I was actually still using this four-generation pedigree chart. I mean, I was still using pencil and paper. I doubt if anybody does it this way then, but that was a handy way, and at least you could put it on a clipboard and take it around with you and jot down notes as you were doing this. The next step, I did talk to some relatives. I just didn't talk to enough of them, and conventional wisdom tells us to begin with our older relatives, I guess thinking that the odds are that they may pass away first. And also, it's good to be mindful that with increasing age, memories are dimmed. But it's also important to remember that younger family members may be doing some of the same things that you're doing, or some of the older family members. So it's just important to talk to all your relatives, and I found that out actually a little bit too late. The next step, and this was actually a lot of fun, was kind of exploring family archives, looking at my mom's house, my grandmother's house, my great aunt's houses, looking for all in all the nooks and crannies for all of the things that they had stored and kept away. Obituaries are a treasure trove of information, and we all, at least in Southern Black community, we all have that one relative who goes to every funeral and who saves all the obituaries. So I connected with, on both sides, that relative who had been to all of the funerals and who had all of the obituaries. Now, she had them up in the attic and stuck in all these little places, and it was fun fighting the critters to get to them. Then I started researching other sources, and I've sort of listed the sources that I have found the most helpful. And at the top of the chart for me have been the census records. The Freedmen's Bureau records, I originally thought that they would not be that helpful for me. And the reason I thought that is because those offices were in major cities. And so since my relatives lived in a fairly small town, I didn't think, and the couple of times I searched, there wasn't really any information about my relatives, but that changed, and I'll tell you how that happened. Cemeteries, obituaries, voter registration records, church histories, birth and death certificates and marriage records, probate records, newspapers, and the Social Security Death Index. So we're going to talk a little bit about each one of these. Census records, really, that's the place where I started. For yes. For African Americans, for Black people of African descent who live in the South and whose ancestors were enslaved, the 1870 census is going to be the first census where our ancestors are listed as people. In prior censuses or census records, you will find the person who claimed ownership, and you will not see names, but you'll see that that person claimed ownership of 20 males and 15 females, and they might break them down by age. But prior to the 1870 census, if your ancestors were enslaved, they're not going to be listed by name. Now, the 1880 census is the census that our church makes available free of charge. So you don't have to have a subscription to Ancestry.com or anything. And that was one of the first places I started. And now, this is not the actual census record. This is what Ancestry.com pulled from the census record. And this is the household of my maternal great-great-grandparents, the one I showed you the picture of. So you see Richard Spencer, you see Edie Spencer, his wife, Eliza Spencer. Brantley was my great-grandfather's. That's who I'm descended from. You see Lugina, and you see Robert Garrison. His name was actually Garrison Hayward, but that's another story we'll get to. And then you notice that there is a nephew down there whose name is Willis White. Remember that different last name, because we're going to talk about that. This is my paternal great-grandparents. And you see Will Roberts, who in 1880 was 78 years old, which would have made him be born in about 1802. His wife, Bonnie, their grandson, Richard Morgan, and then Will's sister, Sylvia. So that was my paternal great-great-grandparents' household in 1880. Now, Freedmen's Bureau records, as I said, they contain information for over 500,000 African Americans in the post-Civil War, the immediate post-Civil War period. These offices were opened in states where Black people had been enslaved. They were supposed to help the former slaves get bank accounts, help them purchase property, help them obtain some different skills, and all sorts of things. As I said, because there was not an office in Sylvania, I thought that I would not be able to find anything. But lo and behold, here's a record that I found on one of my ancestors. Now, Edith, who was married to Richard, according to her death certificate, her maiden name was Robbins. But I was not able to find anything about her parents because, again, before 1870, they would not have been listed on the census. But I knew that she had a brother named George. I knew she had a sister named Dory. So I went back on the Freedmen's Bureau records and I typed in Robbins and I also added Scriven County. And lo and behold, this information on George Robbins popped up. And it gives me his father's name. It gives me his mother's name, and all, part of it is cut off on this picture, but it also gave me the names of some of his siblings, which included Grandmama Edie and her sister Dory, so I knew that I had made that connection. So again, for those of us who battled that wall of slavery, being able to push back one more generation was just wonderful and fantastic. Cemeteries. My daughter laughs at me and says that I spend most of my time when I go to Scriven County in cemeteries making a couple of three circles and waiting for another dead person to pop up. She's a bit irreverent. But the headstones that I'm finding, I know they're not from when my ancestors originally died, but they are other relatives who have erected headstones, who have been out looking. This is the headstone of my, okay, Will was my great-great-grandfather. His son was Bacchus. Bacchus had three wives. His first wife was Clara, whom he married before slavery ended. His second wife was Harriet, who would have been my great-grandmother. And then his third wife was America. That really was her name, America. And so this is Harriet's tombstone. And they've got, in memory of Harriet, wife of Bacchus. Now, sometimes you see Granddaddy Bacchus's name spelled like the Greek god, B-A-C-C-H-U-S. Sometimes you see it spelled like Bacchus out of David Copperfield. So I different things on, I think on his death certificate, it is B-A-C-C-H-U-S. But you remember I told you that I was so excited that Jenkins County had broken away from Scriven County? I was able to find that information on Bacchus because he was one of those relatives who went to sleep one night in one county, woke up the next night in another county, and that county started keeping birth certificates and death certificates. So Bacchus lived until 1920, a year after Georgia started requiring the keeping of birth certificates and death certificates, and I was able to find Bacchus's death certificate, which confirmed that his father had been Will and his mother had been Vonnie. So again, it was just a very somewhat fortuitous that the county split up like that. Obituaries. Obituaries, as I say, can be veritable treasure troves of details and information about your family members. There's a couple of websites, legacy.com. They are part of Ancestry.com, but I know you can get onto those websites even if you don't have a subscription. You may not be able to get all of the information, but you can find some of the information. And then also just make friends with your relative who kept all the obituaries. Voter registration records. I cannot tell you how excited I was when I was able to find, this is Granddaddy Will that I showed you, my paternal great-great-grandfather, born in 1802, he was able to register to vote for the first time in October, is it October? No, August of 1867. So this is his voter's registration certificate. Church histories. Many churches, not just our church, maintain church histories. I can remember as a child going to church anniversaries and being bored to tears when the little old ladies would stand up there and read these pages and pages of church histories. But when I started doing this research, I was very, very happy for those church histories. This is the church history of Ditch Pond Missionary Baptist Church. You can see from the first paragraph, it was opened in 1869. They didn't have a building then. They worshiped under what's called a bush arbor, and that's basically they constructed some bushes to make basically a shelter to keep out the wind and the rain so that they could worship. And then later on, some of the people in the neighborhood helped them with the money, and they built a log church in 1870. But look down to that third paragraph, and you see those names that are listed, brother and sister Handy Best. Those are some of my relatives on, that's my mother's mother's relatives. Richard, brother and sister Richard Spencer, those are the people that you saw pictures of. Brother and sister Albert McGee. Albert McGee married Eliza, who was Richard's daughter. So all of these people that I'm finding here, these are my ancestors, these are my relatives. And as that history continued, I found more of my relatives. So those church histories were just, I was so happy that those little old ladies had kept those church histories. Birth and death certificates and marriage records. Now, this is actually the daughter of George, the one I found in the Freedman's records. This is his daughter, Dory, who is named after his sister, Dory. And again, you find that you'll see mother's maiden name and all of that kind of information. So if you're looking for someone, finding a death certificate that has that information on it helps you push it back just a little bit further. It helps you dig deeper into your roots. Probate records. I always knew that my ancestors were enslaved, but nothing really brings it home to you until you go look at the inventory of the estate of the white person who claimed ownership of your ancestors. And you find the valuation that was placed on your ancestor. If you look up there at that first line, you see Old Jack, Negro man. Old Jack was so old that he was only valued at $200. The next line, you see Frank, who was valued at $1,000, John, who was valued at $1,000, and Dick, who was valued at $1,000. That Dick is my great great-grandfather. So in 1856, when Christopher White died and his estate was valued, my great-great-grandfather was valued at $1,000. What really hits you even more when you look at this, you see the line down there that it says, aggregate value of Negroes, horses, and mules. If nothing else, tells you just how awful, awful, awful the institution of slavery was, where people claimed ownership of other people. It's seeing your ancestor lumped in and valued with the horses and mules. You see that aggregate value was $13,950. The total value of this man's estate was $22,000. So over half of his estate was him claiming ownership of other people. I can't really describe to you the different set of conflicting emotions when I found this. Part of me wanted to do a little jig because, yes, it was further confirmation and more stuff to fill in my family tree. But as I say, nothing really lets you know that you're the descendant of former enslaved persons than seeing your ancestor listed in an inventory. Newspapers. Now, in small towns, and I was from a very small town, you can often find a lot of interesting details about your family. Now, again, this is small town Georgia. When I was a little girl, there was an actual section in the newspaper called the Colored News. And there were a couple of people who wrote, and their stories or whatever they wrote were featured in the Colored News. When I won a baby contest, I was actually featured in the Colored News, a little smiling picture of me right up under the headline that said Colored News. This particular piece of Colored News is talking about my father's second wife dying, Miss Emma. And my father and my brother and my sisters, all of whom were a lot older than I am, they were thanking people for the condolences and all of that. But so when you get over it being called Colored News, you can find quite a bit of information in the newspapers. These are some things I had to remember, and we all need to remember. Don't assume that everyone that has the same surname as you is your relative. Do not reinvent the wheel. Sometimes you've got distant cousins, and there are connections that you don't know about who they've done some of this work. So do a little digging to see if you can find that out. Do not put off talking to and interviewing your relatives. And then this is very important, this last thing. Do not forget that all the records were created by humans, and all the records can contain mistakes. My mother was born in 1929. She was delivered by a midwife, and a lot of the midwives either didn't bother to fill out the birth certificates, or even if they did, which I'm sure her midwife did, because her midwife was the same person who delivered me, so she was and delivered a lot of the white people in the county. The county just didn't record them for some reason. We're not sure where those birth certificates are. So my mother doesn't have a birth certificate. So in my attempts to get my mother a birth certificate, I was trying to use the method of relying on two census records. She was born in 1929. The 1930 census, however, her name is Josie. The 1930 census lists her name as Josephine. That was not her name. And it says that she was 2.5 years old, which was the age of her older sister. Now, by the 1940 census, that census taker got it right. But so I'm having to use other things because I don't have two census records for my mom. So what about slavery? These are just some of the tips and some of the things that have helped me overcome the barrier. Remembering that my ancestors may have relocated from the area where they were enslaved. If that's the case, you're kind of going to have to search in two places. You're going to have to search where they were where they were enslaved, and then you're going to have to search in the place to which they migrated. You have to try to locate the enslavers who claimed ownership of your ancestors. In my case, that wasn't very hard. It is clear to me that there are some family ties between our enslavers and my enslaved ancestors. And the land that my grandfather Brantley started buying, his first purchases were actually from those enslavers. So they lived across the road from each other. Once you locate the last enslaver, you will need to research that family. Remember that after slavery was abolished, your ancestors may have decided not to use the surname of the enslavers, but to adopt a new surname. You remember when I showed you that page of my maternal great-great-grandparents' household, and there was the nephew named Willis White? Well, my great-great-grandfather, at the time that he was held as a slave, or was enslaved, he was called Dick White. When he got his freedom, he decided that he did not want that to be his name. And he took the name Richard Spencer. We don't know where he got the last name Spencer. There were a couple of people who had the first name Spencer. We don't know why that struck his fancy. But in addition to changing his name, he also changed the names of some of his children. My great-grandfather, his slave name was Toby. Granddaddy Dick apparently decided that that was not the name that he wanted his oldest son to have. He named him Brantley. So as you're doing these searches, remember that some of your ancestors, if your ancestors were enslaved people, remember that as they were casting off the vestiges of slavery, one of the things that they cast off was that name of the enslavers. And I found that some people took the names of towns. Some of them took either the first or middle name of a parent or another relative. Some of them just took a first name that was popular at the time and made it their last name. Some of them actually, if they had been working in certain occupations, they would sort of take that occupation and make that into a name. Other people, if stories had been passed down from Africa, they might pick a name that had more linkage to Africa. So it really just depends on your family. And then I also had to remember that that some of my enslaved ancestors had a European, and I put first name and it should have been last name, because they were actually related to the ancestors. Granddaddy Richard did not use the last name White, but his two brothers did, and that's why his nephew was named Willis White. So they kept the name. Granddaddy Dick decided not to. One of the things I've learned as I've been doing this is that some of my ancestors decided at various points to classify themselves as Native American, though actually it shows up as Indian on most of these things, or white rather than black. When that happens, it kind of gets very difficult to keep track of those relatives and those ancestors, because the whole point behind, if you had decided that you needed to pass, the whole point to make that successful, you had to cut ties with those of your relatives who would not be able to pass. So we know that there were at least a couple of my ancestors, because we've got European blood sort of flowing through on various different sides. So we know that some of them were light enough that they were able to pass. And they decided, because for whatever reason, that to do that. And so we've lost track of those relatives. I've also had to learn to be very careful with using any family history report that summarizes the census information, because sometimes that summary will misstate the race of the individuals. I don't know what happens. People get cross-eyed while they're reading it, but you just have to go back to the source documents. And then this is something, I have not run across this in my family, but I have friends in doing their research, they have. One of the hardest things for many of us whose ancestors were enslaved is to come to realize that some of our family members actually enslaved people themselves, including some of their own relatives. So that has been a difficult realization for many of us. Again, we're not walking in their shoes. We're not living their lives. We don't know what the reasons for doing that. Maybe it made everybody's life a little bit better. I don't know. But that's one of those things that you learn. And some of my relatives were very, very resistant to me doing family history research. I had one aunt who said to me, "Child, you're going to mess around and have us all married to our cousins." And then another aunt said to me, "Well, you can't go back too far, baby, because you're going to run into the white people." And I said to her, and I said, "Well, Auntie, if we take the premise that my ancestors, I have an original ancestor that I'm looking for in the, I found you old African vein, who came from Africa, and you look at me, my skin color, then you figure out there were some white people there somewhere." So I think I knew that. So... And then start looking for your African origins. And I had to remember, and I have to keep telling people, when you watch Henry Louis Gates' programs, they're wonderful programs, but they kind of skip all the hard work in the middle. I mean, you don't walk into a room somewhere and punch a couple of keys of a computer and it prints you out this beautiful book that tells you where your it just doesn't work that way. And then I have done DNA testing, and I'm going to show you the results of that. But again, here are my maternal great-great-grandparents, Richard and Edie Spencer. Richard is the one who decided that he did not want to be known as Dick White. He did not want my great-grandfather to be known as Toby White. He didn't want that last name. And he picked him a new last name. Get out of this. So I want to go to my family tree. And let's see. and just talk a little bit. How am I doing on time, Corey? Okay, I'm going to just talk a little bit, and then I'm going to leave some time for questions. Okay, for those of you who came in later, on the very far end over there, that beautiful little face, that's my little grandson, William Ryan Fay. And as I said, my youngest daughter married her elementary school sweetheart, who happened to be a young white man. So as you look through the tree, you will see sort of how the differences of when you're trying to research in the ancestry and your ancestors were enslaved, and on the other side where it was not. I'm going to just click a couple of these arrows and kind of show you the difference. If I go up here to Carl Harold Anderson, you see how leaves just start popping out. Or if I William Martin Fay, and I'm able to go back to 1768, 1797, and there are all these leaves, which mean I can go back even further. And actually, Richard, that's my son-in-law's name, he's got an aunt who has done a lot of research and has traced them back to one side of the ancestry is Swedish, so she's traced it back to Sweden. I mean, she's done all of this. So William Ryan, my little grandson on that side of his family, will be able to trace that all the way back. But now the difference when you look down, and I'm very, very excited for what I've been able to do on my side of the family, but it just points out sort of the difference. If I click on Bertha Best was my grandmother. Here's okay, so you remember I showed you that name, Handy Best? Handy was the brother of Charles. You see Charles up there? Charles was Bertha's grandfather. So Handy, who was one of the ones who was the first members of Ditch Pond Missionary Baptist Church, that's how I was connected to Handy. So you see, I've been able to go back. I'm pretty sure that I'm right about Jack Best and Celia. Don't know a lot about Henrietta's parents. Henrietta died in 1897 in childbirth after having given birth to, I think it was the 11th, 12th, 13th, some huge number of children. So I've not been able to find out a lot about Henrietta, because that would have been long before any death certificates or anything else was kept. So I've not been able to find out a lot about her. No, I don't want to add a new person ancestry. I do want to show my DNA, and then we'll ask some questions. Stop for some questions. Okay, so here is my here are my DNA results when it populates. And if you look over there, you see the highest percentages. It's 36% from the region of Benin Togo, 29% from the region of Cameroon in the Congo, and then 11% Great Britain. And again, I felt, as the young people would say, some kind of way when I got those results. I'm not sure before I got those results that I even knew where the nations of Benin and Togo were. I mean, that's just how much information I don't have. I knew where Cameroon was. I knew where the Congo. But so I know nothing about those areas where my DNA says that I came from. So it was exciting to get that, but it was very, very sobering. And when I posted my results on Facebook, I had quite a few people to express concern about the 11% Great Britain. But again, as I said earlier, I've always been able to look at myself in the mirror and know that there were some white people somewhere. So I was not surprised about that. What I was surprised and disappointed, and I share this fate with a lot of African Americans, is that I have less than 1% of Native American ancestry. But when you sit down and think about it, if you think about the history, the Cherokees were run out of Georgia in the early 1800s. I mean, and they lived in North Georgia. You saw the map, and you saw my family was down in South Georgia. So there really would have been very few opportunities for any interaction or alliances or liaisons between my relatives and the Cherokee and members of the Cherokee Nation. Same thing with the Creek Nation. As my understanding, the Creek Nation was primarily in Alabama, might have been a little bit in West Georgia, but again, separated by miles from my ancestors. So all of us saying we've got our high cheekbones and our straight hair and all the other things that we claimed as our Native American ancestry, that my DNA did not prove that to be so. And I kind of find it, and Tom, you may have experienced this as well, I kind of find it a little bit sad that we as African Americans felt that we needed to have something else to sort of lift us up, that being African American was not enough. So I'm going to close here and open it up for questions. Right. Well, part of it, I guess, is because I'm an attorney. And I knew that my enslaved ancestors would have been considered property. And so I knew that they would have passed as property. And in Georgia and probably every other state, probate records are where you go to find out how property passes. And so that's how I knew to do that. The census records, I think when I discovered the 1880 census, you know, free, the church provided, that let me know that was out there. Cemeteries, again, because my relatives didn't wander a lot. Now, as my ancestors had descendants, a lot of them did migrate to the north in the 40s and the 50s, but I've still got a lot of my relatives living in that small town in South Georgia. So they attended churches there, and those old cemeteries are there. So my daughter is not joking when she says I spend a lot of time out just wandering through old cemeteries and looking at cemetery records. Newspapers, my mom, when she did her thesis, about the political history of the Negroes in Meriwether County, which is the county we had moved to. And I actually helped her do some of that research and realized then what a treasure trove of information a small town newspaper is. So I just applied that same knowledge to the newspaper down in Scriven County. The Sylvania Telephone is the name of the newspaper. So it was some of the knowledge that I had, some talking to other people that were doing, some just digging. When I got a subscription to Ancestry.com, they would talk about birth, marriage, and death records. That introduced you to the Social Security Death Index. So it's one thing sort of fed into another. Yes. And I think you have to wait for him. To me, a genealogical journey is almost like a faith journey. And you have to make that journey for yourself, and you have to be ready to do it. Because I have uncovered a lot of painful things. I've uncovered incest. I've uncovered, just a lot of painful things in doing my family history. So you have to be ready to make that journey. You have to be willing and recognize that when you open the door, there may not be a great surprise behind that door. So I would just suggest to you to, you know, if there are things you can be gathering to keep for him when he reaches that point, you can do that. But you really can't push him into that. Yes.
So you talked a lot about how unbelievably difficult it is to get records for melanated style genealogical research, but you do catch a break on the DNA because the average African is more distantly related to another randomly selected African than a average white person is to an average Asian person because of the very, very deep roots that go back through Africa. So that's really great that you got those. I also wanted to say that on top of that, I feel that people who, you know, are of my complexion tend to really overemphasize how much confidence they can put in these DNA tests because Europeans are just mutts genetically. Everyone, I mean, except for Basques and maybe some Corsicans that are a little genetically distinct, everyone else is basically just one big mix. I mostly work on, marine species. I don't do much human genetics, but I did get DNA out of some people from Jordan from 3,000 BC, 3,000 years ago, and there was a skeleton of people whose house had burned down and fallen on top of them, and they assumed it was a father, mother, and three kids, and it turned out to be three men and two kids, and not only were they not a nuclear family, they were not even the same race, all living together in the same house 3,000 years ago, so it's... Things are very, very complicated, and people who think, I think we all have this idea in our heads that if we go back far enough, then there was this racially pure time when everyone, you know, Swedes were all related to each other somehow, and everyone who lived in America was related to each other somehow, and it just doesn't seem to be true that we're all connected across, and if you dig far enough, you're going to find unwelcome surprises, but you might find some welcome ones, too. I just found out last week that my ninth great aunt was Pocahontas. I had no idea I was anything other than white. So,
great. I think it is. I think that's one of the beautiful things about genealogy is that if we open our minds to it, it does help us to realize how connected we are. Now, if you go into it with a closed mind and expecting it to prove that you're white, 100% white, then it's probably not going to be a lot of fun. But if you go into it with an open mind, it is more fun. Tom, we do need to speak.
I have a voice that carries. One of my questions for you is, you talk about overcoming the barrier of slavery, but what I found in my helping others get started is they don't get to slavery. It takes a lot of work even to put the pieces of the puzzle together between 1940 census and the 1870 census, right? So how long did it take you to get there, and then how long have you focused? You talked about those periods of times when you were the eager dabber and all in and things like that, but how long would you say you've spent getting to that point of slavery?
I really did start with this in 1977 when Roots came out, and it is still a work in progress, so I have not finished, but I was blessed on one hand with my mother's relatives. There's always been someone who could read and write. My mother's relatives, and again, I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable, but apparently always worked as house servants or house slaves, and so they had more access to education than my relatives on my father's side. So there was some degree of a written record on my mother's side, either in the family Bible or these church histories. So that's how I was able to move back fairly quickly on my mother's side. My father's side, I was blessed in a way. My father was 38 years older than my mother. So I didn't have to go very far back on my father's side before I was back. And then because Granddaddy Bacchus's name was so unique, as you're searching through the census records, even though in some records it's spelled Bacchus like the Greek god, and in others it's Barkus like in David Copperfield, but still it's a very unique name, so you could find him. And because he lived until 1920, then again, there was a death certificate for him, and that death certificate had information. So I say that I was blessed because my mother's family had some written records. The people in my father's family just lived a long time, and my father was so much older than my mother to begin with. That's how you get my paternal grandfather having been born enslaved. My father was born in 1891. He was 38 years older than my mother, married her when she was 23 and he was 61. My grandfather, his father, was born in 1864. So,
Brindis, thank you, first of all. You are always so generous with your knowledge and wisdom, and we've just been Facebook friends until now, but you might remember I'm a transracial adoptive mom. I have three sons who are African American, and I'm just always grateful for your sharing your wisdom so that I can do a better job with my kids. The question I want to ask is kind of a big touchy-feely question because, you know, you've worked so hard to overcome these barriers to learning your family history and been so blessed, as you say, to get so much information. And I feel like it's going to be really hard for my kids who have the barrier of slavery and then barriers of poverty and tragedy throughout, you know, the time in between, and then the barrier of adoption. It's like tripled in a way. And I don't know, I don't know how they'll ever overcome those, but I want to ask you about kind of the emotional and spiritual difference that you felt between knowing your general cultural history and knowing your specific family history.
For me, again, we had a history, we had an oral history, so I always knew on both sides that my ancestors were enslaved. I think knowing and then seeing pieces of paper, seeing inventories with your ancestor being listed as property, that was like a stab to the heart. Because the folks really, there are ancestors of the people who enslaved my ancestors, who still live basically across the street from some of my relatives. So it was very much like a stab to the heart. And when I got to my undergraduate school and realized that one of my dear friends at my undergraduate school was a descendant of the family that probably claimed ownership of some of my father's relatives, that was another sort of stab to the heart. So it's one thing to know that that's where you're descended from. It's another thing to get written confirmation, or it's another thing to be sort of going to college with the descendants of the people who held your ancestors in slavery. So I see that people are outside. We need to end. But yeah, that it's difficult, and we'll talk about that more. Thank y'all all so much for coming.